All right, we're recording. Flip this on here. All right, so this is Bible 231, and it is April 11th, Monday. And you just had a little discussion about the clinical care extender program over at St. Mary's, which is really, really good. We're going to cover census chapters today. And one other thing that's kind of happening on campus is that faculty is voting on a contract. And that doesn't necessarily impact you very much, but the contract is changing the scheduling here at Cypress College. You know, there are a lot of colleges and universities that are on a 16-week semester, and we're on an 18-week semester. All right, so it's a little bit longer semester. That means we don't have to cover so much material every week. All right, but faculty are really interested to shortening the semester to make it the same as other colleges. And I suppose you should maybe talk with your instructors about that and let them know what you think about that idea. That means the labs would be a little bit longer. You'd have to learn more each laboratory session. That means the pace of the class would have to pick up. So there are a lot of instructors that think that the pace of their classes is too slow. So if you think that's so, then you would be for the 16-week semester. If you think the pace of the class is fast enough for you or already too fast, then you would probably want to keep the semester length still at 18. So you might just want to write a letter to your newspaper, the college newspaper, in favor of going to the short semester or staying at the long one. Or talk to your instructors about that to give them some guidance if they're interested in knowing how to vote. And I could give you my impression of the short semester versus the long semester. What's my impression? I don't know, you want to do a show of hands first without even thinking about it? Who would like to go to a short semester? Raise your hand. Okay? That means you get more time off between semesters, right? Okay, who would like to stay at just a regular? Maybe a few more students, okay? Or maybe you need to think about it a little bit, but my impression is that going through anatomy and physiology and going any faster, people who think it would be easier, I think they're out of their minds. Okay, but it would be easier because you get more time off. But when you're in school, you'd have to work even harder. But I think that would be expecting a lot of students. But anyway, think about that. Talk to your instructors. Okay, and I don't really want to impact your decision one way or the other, but you should at least be aware that that is something that's happening on campus. Okay, and I don't want you to be taken by surprise by it. Okay, so let's move on to census. And in particular, we're going to look at special census. Okay, so I want to break down all of the senses into two main categories. One is general sensation and one is special sensation. All right, so a general sense is a sense that you have all over your body. So for instance, if I take an ice cube and stick it on your earlobe, could you tell it was cold? What about if I take that ice cube, put it on your belly button? You could tell it was cold. What about your kneecap? It's cold. So temperature is what kind of sense? A special or a general? General, because it comes from all over your body. The same thing for pain, right? If I take a pin and if I poke your earlobe, you're going to feel it. Or the tip of your nose, your belly button, kneecap, or whatever, you'll sense that sensation. All right? Let's see, what are some other general senses? Like touch, okay? Vibration, that's a general sense. Another sense that might be hard to determine if it's general or special is what we call proprioception. It sounds like a special sense, but proprioception is a sense that we get from all the muscles in your body that tell your brain what the length of every muscle is, and also the tension that's being produced in tendons all over your body so that you can move properly. All right, and since you have those sensors all over in every muscle and every tendon, is that a general or a special sense? It's general. So proprioception, even though it sounds special, is still a general sense because it comes from all over the place. Okay. Now, what about if I take a flashlight and shine light into your belly button? Can you see it? Obviously not. What about your kneecap? No. Your elbow? No. Where can you see? Where can you perceive light? Only your eyes, right? Only two very special organs that have a lot of organization. And so vision is a special sense, not a general sense. You don't have those senses from all over your body. All right? And taste. Can you taste with your fingertips? No. What about your elbows? No. Only with your tongue, so that is also a special sense. Only one location you have that at. So vision is one, taste is one, and smelling. Can you smell with your fingertips? No, or your antennae. If we had antennae, some insects maybe have receptors there. But we can only smell with our nose, right? So that's another special sense. The sense of smelling is called olfaction, O-L-F-A-C-T-I-O-N, olfaction. The sense of taste is what we call gustation. All right, so they got special terms, and of course seeing is vision. All right, so that is what? That's three. And what about hearing? Is that special or general? Special, because you can only hear with your ears. And there's two other senses associated with the ears, and it has to do with equilibrium. Those are special senses as well. All right, so they give you a sense of linear acceleration and also of angular acceleration when you start to spin. We're going to talk about those two. So one is called static equilibrium, which has to do with linear acceleration, and the other is kinetic equilibrium that has to do with spinning or angular acceleration. All right, so those are what we're going to talk about in this chapter, special senses. So let's talk about the sense of smell first, or what's the proper term for smell? Olfaction, that's right. All right, so these are all exteroceptors, so these senses allow us to communicate with the environment. And so there are molecules in the environment that we call odors. And these odors have to enter the nasal cavity. So let's look at the PowerPoint slide on the right. These molecules have to enter the air that we're breathing in. And right at the top of the nasal cavity is the ethmoid bone. As a matter of fact, that's the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. And when you look at it in lab, you saw that it was perforated with all kinds of foramina. And we call those the olfactory foramina, because indeed there are olfactory nerves that come down from the olfactory bulb and enter the nasal cavity right here. And this is an interesting part of the body, because this is really the only part that has part of your nervous system that is really outside of your body, just dangling around in free space right here, like this. And here is a nice zoomed in region of the cribriform plate, and here's the olfactory foramina with olfactory nerves, and it moves down through the bone into the epithelium. And here are the ends of these nerve fibers that we call olfactory cilia, and there are receptors on these olfactory cilia that bind certain odor molecules, which then set up electrical signals then that end up going to the brain. All right, so those odors actually have to bind to receptors on these neurons. Oh, what kind of neuron is that? Did you have to know that for the last test? Oh, you had to know that for the last test. That's a nice bipolar neuron right there, right? So we said that was one of the few places where you find bipolar neurons, and that is for special senses. Here's a good example. All right, and since these neurons actually are outside your body, right on the surface of your body, they have a really hard life, which means that anything you breathe into your body has, or like water, if you get water up your nose, can actually touch these receptors right here. And so they don't live for very long, just a couple weeks, and then they're replaced by these other supporting cells or stem cells, which we call a basal cell right here. They differentiate and become a neuron and replace these that eventually die. Actually, these die fairly rapidly. All right, so what do you know about replacing damaged cells in your body, especially nerve cells? Is that something that gives you an impression that's easy to do or hard to do? Probably hard, right? Like when somebody has a spinal cord injury, they never overcome that because those neurons in the spinal cord never regenerate and learn how to hook back up to muscles and things like that. But here, we see some nerve cells that are designed to do what? To be replaced at a fairly regular interval. That's kind of interesting. Maybe somebody someday will be able to take these kinds of nerves and transplant it into somebody's spinal cord. And what are these nerves trained to do? Regrow, right? And maybe somebody can overcome some spinal cord injuries that way. But now what might happen if we take some of these olfactory nerves and put them in somebody's back? Well, maybe they'll smell with their back then. Okay, well, I'm just kind of kidding. That probably wouldn't happen. But anyway, it's something kind of like science fiction to think about. Okay, so here we have the sense of olfaction, and remember, a molecule has to bind to these olfactory cilia. So if there's a molecule on the other side of the room and it stays over there, could you smell it? No, that molecule actually has to travel, enter the nasal cavity, okay, and bind to a receptor in these nerves right here. And it, as a matter of fact, if you really want to smell something, what do you have to do to get a good sensation of that molecule? Yeah, you have to get close to it, and you have to sniff it, because where does that air have to go? All the way up over here to the roof of that nasal cavity. Okay. So there are many different kinds of odors. We have thousands of different kinds of receptors, and some people have broken down the sense of smell into some primary odors. For instance, like flowery is one kind, etheric, like ether, maybe you've smelled ether, musky, and camphorous, a sweaty smell, rotten, like from rotten apple eggs and things like that, and then a stinging smell from like acids, like from vinegar and things like that. And depending on the combination of all these different kinds of senses, then your brain will put the proper percentage and combination together for you to figure out what it is you're actually smelling. So that's sort of interesting. So you got to have different receptors that smell these different kinds of odorants or odor molecules. Okay, so that's pretty much what you have to know about olfaction. These mitral cells right here, this is the cell body. And these are the cells then that receive signals from the bipolar cells that send them to the olfactory cortex for you to have that sense of smell. All right, and these mitral cells you find in the olfactory bulb. And you were just looking at some of those structures in the brain last week. All right, the sense of gustation is the sense of taste. Right, and we can taste with our tongue, so here we have a tongue. And if you stick your tongue out in the mirror and go, ah, you see that it's not just a flat, smooth surface, it's kind of a velvety surface. And all those things that you are looking at, commonly people call those taste buds. But those really aren't taste buds. What we see over here on the slide, this right here is a taste bud. And a taste bud has some support cells, and it has a taste cell or gustatory cell, and on the top of that cell, just like for olfaction, there are some cilia that are sticking off of it, and there's receptors, right? So a molecule has to dissolve in saliva and bind to a receptor that's on those different cilia. So here is a cell, and what do I have the cursor on right here of this particular cell? That's the nucleus of a cell. So can you see a cell or a nucleus of a cell with just your naked eye? No. What do you need? You need a microscope. So here you see a cell. So in order to see a taste bud, what do you really need to have? You need a microscope. So when you look at the surface of your tongue in a mirror, you can't really see the taste buds because you need a microscope to see them. What you actually are looking at, okay, are big projections coming off that have hundreds of these taste buds on them. And those projections are what we call papillae, right? And you have different kinds of papillae depending on what part of the tongue it is. You have the fungiform that's near the tip, and you have the valate down over here in between the fungiform, and then you have the lingual papillae more toward the base of the tongue, right? And these have different kinds of receptors on them. So here you see a papillae, and they're lined with taste buds, and there's a pore for each one of these taste buds over here. The sense of taste is not so complicated compared to smell. There are really only about five different sensations for taste, and here they are. The primary taste sensations are sweet and sour, bitter, salty, and there is a sense of fulfillment when you eat something that's delicious, and we call that umami. So that's a sensation of fulfillment or deliciousness when you eat something. And that's pretty much from amino acids when you eat them, like monosodium glutamate is a molecule that binds to umami receptors. All right, so you could probably imagine that when you taste something, it's a combination of these various primary tastes, and from depending on the percentage of these receptors that are being activated, you could tell what it is that you're eating. And as a matter of fact, could you tell me something that is sweet and sour and maybe a little bitter and salty all at the same time? Like what? What would that be? Anybody have an example of what kind of food or maybe beverage that would be? How about a margarita? Anybody ever had a margarita? If you haven't, maybe you should have one later or next year sometime when you're old enough. Okay. Well, margarita is sweet, but it's also salty because where do they put salt? Right on the rim of the glass, right? And there's some lemon juice in there. Everybody's salivating now. Okay. Thinking of a margarita. And depending on which of these receptors are excited, then your mind can reconstruct what kind of food that is. Okay, so taste buds are composed of basal cells, so these basal cells then can repopulate those neurons just like they do for the sense of smell. And the molecule has to bind to a receptor, so you can't taste a molecule that's in the far corner of the room that actually has to enter your mouth and enter a taste bud through this taste pore and bind to a receptor. And then makes its way to a part of the brain, the parietal lobe, which is the sensory lobe for gustation. All right, so that's two special senses. Let's move on to vision. So vision, again, is a special sense because you can only see with your eyes, and there are some receptors that can pick up light. Those are photoreceptors, but there are many structures with the eye that aren't directly responsible for vision, but we call these accessory structures because they help protect the eye or let the eye do its job properly. For instance, we have eyebrows above the eyes right here. These are important, so it will give you some information if there's debris falling from your head into your eyes, right? And so if you feel that debris hitting your eyebrows, what are you going to do? You're going to blink, right? And that's going to protect your cornea, which is the outermost clear part of the eye that I see right here and right here. And remember in lab we said that the cornea is loaded with numerous nerve endings, especially for pain. And if the cornea is damaged, that will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you probably can experience, right? So it's good that you have these sensors around the eye that allow you to blink. The same thing for the eyelashes that are on the margins of the palpebrae. Remember, a palpebra is just an eyelid. That's a scientific name for a palpebra. So here's the superior palpebra. Here's the inferior one. And again, stimulation of these eyelashes causes you to blink and then protects your eye right here. So those are all accessory structures. Some other accessory structures, there's a lining on the interior surface of a palpebra, and that's what we call the conjunctiva. Right, so that's the palpebral division of the conjunctiva, and then here is the orbital or the bulbar division of the conjunctiva that's right on the surface of the eye bulb itself. Right, that's the membrane, and sometimes you can get an infection of that membrane right there. Does anybody know what that's called? Just for fun, that's called pink eye. Not terribly difficult disease to treat, pretty easy to treat, but one notable thing is what? Highly contagious. Right, you can have it in one eye, and it will transfer to the other eye because we're always scratching our eyes, or from you to your children very, very easily. Okay, so that's one thing to know about that. So here's the palpebra, here and here, and there are some tarsal glands in each eyelid that secrete an oily film over the eye, right, and that keeps your cornea from drying out, that little oily film right here, coming from these tarsal glands. And I think in lab you had to know this muscle, the levator palpebrae superioris. This does what? A levator does what? It elevates something, and what does it elevate? And eyelid, in which one? The superior one. This gets a little weak as we get older, right? And our eyelid starts to droop down over our eye a little bit every day, like unnoticeable amount. So by the time you're 65, 70 years old, it's actually maybe drooping down over this black spot right here. That black spot is called the pupil, and that's how light enters the eye. But if the palpebrae is hanging over the pupil right there, how much light is entering the eye? Not very much. So a little bit every day, people kind of lose their vision without really knowing it, right? And that's really important when you get to be up in age like that, because then you could easily trip on something. All right, so when you go home, take a look at your grandma and grandpa, and if their eyelids are really drooping over their pupils right here, right, sometimes it's important to have cosmetic surgery or interventional cosmetic surgery to elevate that palpebrae so that they can actually see properly, right? So they don't trip. Because that could be a fatal accident for them, right? When you get really old like that, when you trip, you can't always catch yourself and get your balance before you fall. So that's pretty important to do. All right, so we're still talking about some accessory structures. There are other glands. Here's another gland associated with the eye. And this doesn't produce an oily solution. This is a watery solution. This is a lacrimal gland. It produces tears. All right, so the lacrimal gland on the superior lateral part of the orbit right here secretes tears, which go through the excretory ducts, which then flows over the surface of the globe, and gravity is going to pull it inferiorly like this, and it's going to end up over here in the angle of the eye, the medial angle of the eye. This little funny piece of skin is called a caruncle. Ooh, it's not on your list. You don't have to know that. Okay, but there's a little hole right here called the lacrimal punctum, which drains tears into these little canals, lacrimal canals, which drain into the nasal lacrimal duct, and then that drains right into the nasal cavity, right? So when you're producing a lot of tears, maybe when you're really sad or something, that's why you get a runny nose as well, because where do those tears end up? Right here in your nose, and then just come dribbling right out of your nose. So these are what? Accessory structures for vision. They don't allow you to see, they just help protect the eye in doing what its job really is. Okay. Also, there are some extrinsic eye muscles. So here's the globe of the eye, and these dark red structures are muscles, and I see some that are just straight. That's a rectus muscle. Then there's some that attach to the eye at an angle. Above and below it, those would be the oblique. So here's the superior oblique, here's the inferior oblique. And then as far as the rectus go, what, you got a medial, lateral, a superior, and inferior for the four oblique muscles. Maybe in lab, you have to know what these are named, but it's easy to know because the landmark that you would use to know that this would be the superior rectus as opposed to this one down here, what would you use for a landmark to know? Because if you just look at an eyeball, it's just circular, right? You can't tell what's up or down if you just look at a circle. But what is marking the superior lateral part of the eye? It's the lacrimal gland. So then you would know that this would be the superior oblique, and then the inferior oblique would be down over here. I'm sorry, superior rectus, inferior rectus, lateral rectus, and medial rectus would be over here. As long as you can see that lacrimal gland, that's pretty easy to tell. Okay, there is a cranial nerve. Did you have cranial nerves on the last test? No, you didn't. That's on the one coming up. There is one called the abducens. Okay, what does abduction mean? Think of an arm or a leg. Okay, abducens means what? Move away from midline, right? Adduct is toward midline, abduction is away. So the abducens is a nerve that goes to a muscle that moves your eyeball away from midline to look off to the side. So the abducens nerve doesn't stimulate both the right and left. It will just stimulate one eyeball, like my right eyeball if I look off to the right. So what muscle does the abducens go to? Abducens produces abduction. Does it go to the medial rectus, superior, inferior, or lateral rectus? It's going to stimulate the lateral rectus to contract, and then your gaze will be off to the right, if it's the right eyeball. Okay, so sometimes in anatomy, the more that you have to know, the easier it gets, right? Just don't forget anything about those bones and muscles and things like that, and motion, that's really helpful. All right, and again, these extrinsic eye muscles, these are what? Accessory structures for vision. Okay, so I'll mention those a little bit in a little bit more detail. And then your quiz for today is actually of the globe itself, which is this right here. Okay, and I think I sent this out to you because I had a lot of questions over the weekend. What was going to be on the quiz? And so this was it. Who didn't get this email? Anybody didn't get this email? If you didn't get this email, then you got to check your email address in Blackboard. Make sure it is there for you. All right, so the eye has got three main layers. The outermost layer, we talked about this in lab, is the sclera. That's the really tough hard part, kind of like the dura mater. And it's probably, maybe, well, it's thicker, so it's probably tougher than the dura mater around the brain. Some of you cut into it, notice how hard it was, a lot of connective tissue. It gives the eyeball its shape, and the shape of the eyeball right here really determines, if you're not wearing glasses, how well you can see. So the distance from the cornea to the back of the eye right here allows you sharpness in vision. All right, so if your eyeball is too long because the sclera doesn't have the right shape, then you need glasses. Or if your eyeball is too short, you need glasses because the shape of the sclera is wrong. All right, so that's the first layer. As you go to the anterior pole of the eye, the sclera changes from a lot of connective tissue to having very thin, clear tissue so that light can enter the eye. So the cornea really is specialization of the sclera, but remember, it's very delicate and it's loaded with nerve endings. The sclera is not. It's really tough. The next layer right here looks red. That's the choroid. It has a lot of blood vessels in it. So it nourishes the sclera on the inside, and it also nourishes the deepest layer or third layer of the eye, and that's the retina. The retina has photoreceptor cells in it. So that is the layer that's most directly responsible for your vision. That's the retina. All right, so can you remember these layers? You got, come on, cursor, you got sclera, choroid, and retina right here. Okay. There are two major chambers inside the eye, and they're separated right here at this line of demarcation, which part of it contains the lens. In front of the lens, of course, this is anterior, so we call this the anterior segment. So this contains aqueous humor, which is like a watery material. Everything behind, posterior to the lens, we call that the posterior segment of the eye, and that contains vitreous humor, that gooey, jelloid-like stuff that we saw in lab. Okay. And furthermore, this anterior segment right here has two cavities associated with it, and those two cavities are separated by this structure, which is the iris. In front of the iris, or anterior to the iris, this is what we call the anterior cavity. Back behind the iris, this is the posterior cavity. But nonetheless, the posterior cavity and the anterior cavity are still part of what? The anterior segment inside the eye, which contains aqueous humor, which is produced by this material right here, which is part muscle, which we call the ciliary body, and some other materials that produces that watery fluid. Oh, what do we call that watery fluid? Aqueous humor, that's right. And so it flows from this posterior cavity into the anterior cavity. How would you get from the posterior cavity into the anterior cavity right here? Right through the? Yeah, right through this hole in the iris that we call the pupil, right? So not only does the pupil allow light to enter, but it allows aqueous humor to move from the posterior to the anterior cavity in the anterior segment of the eye. So that's an important foramen. So remember, pupil is not really a structure. It's just a foramen in the iris. And the iris is important because it can constrict, making the pupil small, or it can dilate, making the pupil large, depending on the light conditions. If it's very bright, right, then the iris is going to contract. When it's dim like we have in here so that you can see the projector, your pupils are probably dilated, right? So that black spot looks really large, letting a lot of light into the eye. So the iris is changing shape all the time, depending on light conditions. Now, the cornea doesn't change shape. Its shape is fixed all the time. All right, now, but here is something else that changes shape all the time, and that is the lens. It can get really thick or thin. When it's thick, there's a lot of curvature, and when it's stretched out, when it gets thin, then it flattens out. So in order to bend light so that it focuses right here on the retina, there has to be some curved surfaces that bend light. It has to act like a lens. So the lens has curvature to it. I can see how that's going to focus light, but you see another curved structure on the eyeball that actually helps bend light so it focuses on the retina right here. And light has to pass through it. Look at what's right on the anterior pole of the eye right here. This is the cornea, right? And the cornea, because it's curved, does a big job, actually most of the job, of focusing light on the retina. okay? Not necessarily the lens, but the cornea has fixed curvature, the lens has a variable curvature, so you need to have a lens that can change shape in order to see things close up, right? Or far away, but you can't see both at the same time, right? If you put your fingernails in front of you, your fingertips in front of you, and focus on your fingernails, they're in focus, but what about everything in the background? They're blurry. And then without moving your fingers, if you look in the background, that now all of you are in focus, but what about my fingertips then? They're out of focus. Does anybody remember what that process is of changing your distance of focus from close up to far away, changing the shape of the lens right there? That's called accommodation. Yeah, that's real important, right? So accommodation allows you to see things close up and then also far away. The tension is adjusted by this muscle right here that we call the ciliary body. And what attaches the ciliary body to the lens is a little bit of a misnomer. It's called the suspensory ligament. But what do you typically call a muscle-to-bone connection? A tendon. Yeah, you know, maybe I would have called it the suspensory tendon because it's attached to a muscle right here. But people commonly call it the suspensory ligament. And that changes the shape of the lens. So the shape of the lens is changing all the time. The shape of the iris is changing all the time, which is another really good reason why to take care of the cornea right here, right? Don't ever get the cornea perforated with an object that hits your eye, because if there's a rip in the cornea, this fluid, which is what we call what? Aqueous humor, will just run right out of the eye because it's just water. All right, so it will hurt really bad, but also, there's no fluid then separating the cornea from the lens, and they'll touch each other. There's no fluid separating the iris from the lens, and they can touch each other, right? As a matter of fact, the cornea can actually touch the lens through the pupil right here, right? And the really sad thing is no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick these structures once they touch each other, right? So they're going to get glued together. But what can you tell me about the normal function of the iris? Should it just be stationary? Should it be glued to something? No, it should be changing all the time, right? What about the lens? Should it be glued in place or is it changing all the time? It's changing all the time as well. And when these things get stuck together, that just produces massive vision deficits in that individual, right? So it's always a good idea to wear glasses, right? Especially if you're a guy doing weird things like, what, working on your car, riding motorcycles. Well, ladies ride motorcycles, but what else? Putting swing sets together for your kids in the backyard. Always wear eye protection because you might lose a lot of your good vision, right, if that cornea gets perforated. That would be terrible if that happens. Okay, let's see. That's pretty good for the eyeball. Some other things. Oh, no, I do want to go back. Okay, so here's the retina. The retina has two different kinds of photoreceptors. And they're named by their shape. One is a rod cell, the other is a cone cell. The cone cells are really small. They're found mostly right at the posterior pole of the eye. And this is where we would like to have light reach because those cone cells give us our best vision. So light is going to come in the pupil. And what do you use to get the light to go back right to this area right here, which is called the macula lutea? You actually move your eyeballs around. Using what? Your extrinsic eye muscles so that light hits exactly this spot right here. That's your central vision. That's your highest acuity right here in the macula lutea. And then in the very center of the macula lutea is the fovea centralis that has only 100% cone cells. Okay, so cone cells give you very precise vision. And as a matter of fact, cone cells are the kinds of receptors that give you color vision as well. For those of you that can see colors, okay? Right there. There's a trade-off. Because those cone cells are so small, the light has to be very bright. So cone cells only work in bright light, but they give you your best vision. As you move away from this posterior pole out to the periphery, cone cells start to share their space with rod cells. Rod cells are bigger, so that means they can see in dim light. All right, so don't need as much light for them to sense it, but the trade-off there is that rod cells only see in shades of gray. All right, so they see black and white vision, and they can only see coarse detail. But at least you can see things with your peripheral vision, not as clear or in color, but but in dim light, you can use them to see with. So like if you go out tonight real late and the moon is out, and maybe there's a half of moon, you can still see, but can you see colors? Not very well, right? Because it's just not bright enough. You need really good sunlight. Well, I need really good sunlight to see colors really, really well, okay? And probably everybody does too. Okay, so that's the difference between rod and cone cells, where they're populated in the retina, and what their job is. So those photoreceptors have to be in the retina. That retina has to be attached to the choroid, because that's how those photoreceptor cells get nourishment from the blood. Right? Head trauma that can dislodge the retina from the choroid right here, and in lab you saw how easy that was to separate the retina from the choroid. Then those cells will die because they can't get nourishment from the blood right here, and then you'll have a blind spot in that part of your visual field, which is pretty disturbing. Okay, like for instance, there's a disease process where the cells of the macula actually start to degenerate, and people lose their vision right in the very center. So if you put your fingertips, not right on your eye, but in front of your eyes, but right in front, like right that, that's what somebody with macular degeneration experiences. Whenever they look at something, it's like their fingertips are right there. So they can only see with their peripheral vision. That's pretty disturbing, but at least they have some vision, right? That's better than nothing at all. And the reason why I'm mentioning blind spots, because here's the optic nerve. Ooh, what cranial nerve is optic nerve? Ah-ha-ha. Two? Okay, remember, what's one? Nose, olfactory nerve, then optic nerve, right? Okay, then oculomotor, then trigeminal, but you guys will work on that sometime. Over spring break a lot, probably, right, with your mnemonics. Okay, so here's the optic nerve. It attaches to the retina right here, and here are some blood vessels. And notice, it's pushing the retina away. So you don't have any photoreceptor cells in this region whatsoever. So we actually have a blind spot that we've grown up with our whole life, and we don't see it anymore. Because information from our other eye, which has a blind spot in a different location, shares information with the other part of the brain that fills in this information right here, so you don't see it. But if you want to see your blind spot, I can show you how to see it in lab. Okay, we don't have time in lecture to do that, but it's pretty easy to find right there. Okay, now you can get other blind spots too. There are other disease processes that affect the retina, because the retina requires a lot of oxygen to make ATP. It's highly metabolic. So for instance, somebody with high blood pressure, okay, can get retinopathies, can develop blind spots, diabetes mellitus, because it disrupts the vasculature. People can eventually go blind. All right, so not somebody with hypertension or diabetes will go blind, but we say it's uncontrolled diabetes or uncontrolled blood pressure, right? So if you have any family members with diabetes or hypertension, you have to be really nice and gentle with them, but be very supportive that they take their medications and monitor their situation, right, to control their blood sugar and blood pressures. That's really important, because one of the consequences would be what? Blindness. Yeah, so that's real important. And of course, with each of those diseases, that probably won't be the worst thing that could happen to them, because they could also die, right, if it's uncontrolled for a period of time. Okay, let me talk about this lens a little bit right here. We say it has to change shape. It has to get really thick and curved when you see things close up, and really flat and thin when you're looking at things far away. We call that accommodation. And unfortunately, as we get older, this lens gets a little bit stiffer, like other parts of your body, you might notice as you get older, gets stiffer. And so as you get older, you can't see quite as well. You can't see things up close or far away, or you can't change the way that you're looking at something very rapidly, like we can when we're our age, right? You could be zooming down the 405 freeway, maybe when you're 65, 70 years old. Will you be zooming down the 405 when you're 70 years old? Probably not zooming, because how are they driving? Like 45, 50 miles an hour, right? Kind of slowing traffic down, kind of upsets everybody. But, okay, you got to be concerned about them, because, right, even though they can't see up close, all right, but not far away at the same time, it takes more time for their eyes to adjust. So when somebody's 70, what are they worried about? They don't want to get a speeding ticket, because, right, then they got to go through all that. They might get their license yanked and they'll never drive again. So what are you concentrating on? You're staying under the speed limit, right? So you're looking at your speedometer, which is up close, right? So you're accommodated for looking up close, but what's another thing that you're worried about? You don't really want to be on the 405 freeway, so you want to make sure you don't miss your exit. But where's your exit? It's far away. So you look up from the speedometer, and what do you see? Nothing. It's just a blur. 1001, 1002, then things kind of come into focus, and then you see your exit. And then you go, ah, sigh, relief. I didn't pass my exit because then I have to be on the freeway longer. All right, so you didn't miss your exit. Oh, geez, but now what are you worried about? Am I speeding? And so you look down at the speedometer, and what do you see? Nothing. It's a blur, right? 1001, 1002, 1003, and then you see, ah, I'm going 40 miles an hour. All right. So then I'm relaxed. I'm not speeding. But then what are you worried about? Your exit. Am I going to miss my exit? I don't want to miss. And then you look down the freeway, and what do you see? Nothing. It's a blur, right? 1001, 1002. So this is why, okay, they drive so slowly, so you should be really kind to them. Stay out of their way, right? And just be really kind to those viejitos out there because they can't see as well as all of you young people, right? Huh? There's nothing you can do to avoid that. Well, maybe there is. There are glasses that have bifocals in them or progressives like I have. So depending on where you point your head, you can see at a specific distance, right? So moving your head like this is faster than actually letting the lens change. But if you can't be, ways to prevent this as well as macular degeneration is to stay out of sunlight because the ultraviolet light in sunlight is very damaging to the macula lutea, fovea centralis. It's damaging to the lens. It makes it stiffer, but it also makes it opaque. All right, so as we get older, and probably all of this to some degree already have some opacity of the lens right here. It gets cloudy, right? And we call that, does anybody know what we call that when the lens becomes cloudy? It's called a cataract, okay? And as a matter of fact, and that's not reversible, some people's lenses are so opaque that it's like they're in a thick fog, so it's better to take the lens out completely, right? When they get cataract surgery, and then sometimes they can put in a fake lens or you have to wear bigger glasses, but then you don't have that ability to accommodate anymore, but at least you can see. Okay, so again, cataracts and ultraviolet light can also damage the cornea, but primarily the lens right here and the macula lutea, which is another good reason to wear glasses. But not just glasses, but ones that are made out of plastic, because plastic specifically absorbs ultraviolet light, which is the most damaging wavelength for you. So even if you don't wear glasses, you should at least wear plastic sunglasses when you're outside to prevent cataracts and macular degeneration and other harmful effects on the eye right here. Okay, so that's a good thing to do to start when you're really young, right? Because it won't make sense when you're young because you see perfectly. But by the time you get up there, 60, 70 years old, then you would think, gee whiz, it would have been a good time for me to wear sunglasses, right? Okay, way back when. Okay, so one other thing. So the lens bends light so it focuses on the retina, but so does the cornea right here. All right, so the two most important structures for giving you good vision are the cornea and lens working together. That's why I have a little asterisk right here and a little asterisk on the lens. These two things work together to give you sharp vision. And this is the reason why some people get that LASIK procedure, right, that actually when their vision is really poor, it reshapes the curvature of the cornea so that light now focuses on the retina. And that's a pretty nifty surgery, except it is eye surgery, and I suppose things could go wrong with it, and that's your vision you're talking about. So I don't really recommend a LASIK procedure for purely cosmetic reasons, because things can go wrong with it, and other reasons, maybe I'll mention really quick. And the other reason is because glasses are so good for your eyes. They protect your eyes from ultraviolet light and other kinds of things. What can you tell me about your vision? Is it the same over your whole life or does it change? It changes all the time. And when you get a LASIK procedure, it corrects your vision for that one point in your life. It doesn't change like your eye normally would change anyway. All right, so there are some treatments now where they can redo a LASIK procedure depending on how it was done the first time. But I don't know. I'm not really for it, unless your vision is so poor you can't even find your glasses in the morning, okay, then a LASIK procedure is beautiful, wonderful, it will change your life, right? That's a really wonderful procedure then. Okay, so we talked about the various tunics of the eye. The fibrous tunic is made of the sclera, but remember the cornea is part of the sclera. The vascular tunic, which contains the choroid, and in lab you saw that it was a very dark area, so there's melanocytes in there that helps absorb light so you don't see flashes of light. The iris is part of the vascular tunic as well. And then the neural tunic, or sensory tunic, right, contains those rod cells and cone cells in there. And I think the only other slide that I want to show you, well, here is just a zoomed-in region of the retina. And you can see this photoreceptor cell looks kind of yellow to me in the blue one. What is this? What do we call this yellow one right here? What were the two kinds? Rod cells and cone cells. What does this one look like? That's a cone cell, right? Just like a conehead person. And then here is a rod cell. Okay, because it looks like a rod right there. So these are very sensitive to light. The cone cells are insensitive, but then what's the cool thing about a cone cell? Allows you to see what? Colors. That's real important. So high acuity and color vision. And here we can see some more of those bipolar cells. Where do we have typically bipolar neurons? Special senses, right? So here's another example of a special sensory organ. Okay, some more rod cells and cone cells. I had a flow diagram right here. Maybe it's not part of the... here. Sorry about that. Okay, so here's the lens, right? So here's a ciliary body. Here's the ciliary muscle that applies tension or releases tension on this suspensory ligament. These ciliary processes right here, this is what's responsible for making aqueous humor, which flows between the iris and the lens and through the pupil, then into the anterior cavity right here, and then into the scleral venous sinus, and then that's returned to your circulation. So there's a little circulation, sort of like cerebrospinal fluid. If this venous sinus gets plugged up, or if the ciliary processes start to secrete too much aqueous humor, then pressure builds up in this anterior segment of the eye. And when pressure builds up here, it presses on the lens posteriorly, and then the lens presses on the vitreous humor. And then I want to go back to a previous slide, like right here. And then the vitreous humor presses on the retina, starving the retina of blood that's in the choroid right here. All right, and then so again, the retina will eventually die when there's too high a pressure in this anterior segment of the eye. And that's a very, probably you all know what that disease process is called. That's called, I forgot. Glaucoma, thank you. That's called glaucoma, right? So it kills the retina right here. So this is a good reason for you to have an eye exam every year, even though your vision is perfect. You don't need glasses. Right, but if you have medical insurance coverage, you should get that eye exam because they check the pressure in the segment right here, and you go blind every year a little bit by little bit, you won't notice glaucoma happening. And it's so easily treated, preventing blindness, you should just get that checked every year, like a lot of different kinds of exams. So have you ever been to get your eyes checked and they blow a little air? There's a little puff of air right on the cornea right here, and then they watch how far the cornea bends, or maybe the vibrations, and they can tell what the pressure is inside this area. So that's a really easy test to take, prevent you from going blind. That's really handy. Okay. So we got bipolar cells in there, rods and cones, ganglion cells make up the optic nerve, right? And can you remember from lab where the optic nerves cross over? That's the chiasma right there, and then on the other side is the optic tract, taking signals into the thalamus. And remember, the thalamus is a relay station for signals going to the cortex. And can anybody tell me what the visual cortex is? What part of the brain, the cerebrum, is the visual cortex? It is the occipital lobe way in the back. Okay? So the thalamus sends the signals to the occipital lobe. All right, so that's pretty much it for vision. Anybody have any questions on vision? Doing pretty good for vision. All right, well, let's move on to the year. I can talk about the year for just a little bit yet. Okay, so let's start right here. There are three main parts to the year. So here we're looking at it here. This is all kind of drawn to scale right here. Maybe this region right here is zoomed just a little bit, but not too bad. It's almost all to scale. So the external ear, well, the three main regions, the external ear, the middle ear, and the internal ear. Sometimes we call the internal ear the labyrinth because it's a whole set of really funny shaped bones, bony structures inside the temporal bone. And that's the thickest part of the temporal bone. Anybody remember when we looked inside the cranial vault, the thickest part of the temporal bone, we gave it a special name. Started with a P. It was the petrous region. So the petrous region is big and thick because it contains the labyrinth, which contains three senses. So I'll tell you what those three senses are. This part right here that looks like a snail, that's for hearing. This part right here that looks like a little bulge, that's for static equilibrium. And these that look like little circles, these are for what we call kinetic equilibrium. So you got hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. All right, let's go over the main parts of the ear. External ear, starting with the auricle, which is an auricle is just a flap of skin. Sometimes we call it the pinna right here that helps focus sound energy into the external acoustic meatus. And that continues in the temporal bone. You had to know the external acoustic meatus on that temporal bone right here. And it can only go this far before it bumps into something. And this is what we call the tympanic membrane. And sound is a pressure wave that varies above atmospheric pressure and then below, goes above and below, up and down all the time. And so the tympanic membrane is going to vibrate back and forth. It's going to be pushed in when the sound wave is above atmospheric pressure. And it's going to kind of poke out of your head when it's below atmospheric pressure. And this membrane has to vibrate back and forth in order for you to hear anything. So if there's something that's holding it in place, guess what? You can't hear anything. Yeah, if you were watching me, I said you couldn't hear anything. All right, so this is the external ear right here. The middle ear starts at the tympanic membrane, and it goes to another membrane right here that we give it its name by its shape. So what's the shape of this thing right here? Is it a square? Is it a triangle? Or is it a circle? I didn't give you the right answer. It is what? An oval. All right, so that's what we call the oval window right here at the base of this little bone that we call the stapes because it looks like a little stirrup that you would use to ride a horse with. And that's the oval window. Here is the window into the middle ear called the tympanic membrane. Which membrane is bigger, tympanic or oval? Tympanic is a lot bigger, right? So the tympanic membrane vibrates back and forth, and it stimulates these little bones right here to vibrate. So here's the malleus, the incus, and the stapes, these three. And I could hold all three between my fingers, and you couldn't say that I didn't have them because they're that small. Okay, they fit inside that petrous region right there. They have to vibrate back and forth, carrying sound energy from this external acoustic meatus into the labyrinth right here. And because this is a bigger membrane than the oval window, that acts like a little amplifier because it's really hard for sound energy to enter water, which is inside the labyrinth right here. If you ever put your head when you're swimming underwater, can you hear people talking on the pool deck? Maybe a little bit, but hardly, okay, because sound doesn't like to get inside the pool. Try that over the weekend, okay? So this pressure right here should be the same atmospheric pressure as the external acoustic meatus, right? But that's inside your ear. So here is a little tube that makes sure the pressure is the same so that the tympanic membrane can vibrate back and forth. This little tube connects to your throat. The anatomical name for your throat is pharynx. So that's why this thing is called the pharyngotympanic tube because it goes from your pharynx to this area here that has the tympanic membrane. It's also called the auditory tube. It's also called the eustachian tube. So that's how it is in anatomy. Sometimes you have a structure that has all kinds of different names, like you do, right? And you can, on a practicum, you could use any one of those names. That's fine with me. And sometimes you might not be able to hear very well, like if you're driving up in the mountains or driving back down from the mountains or going up in an airplane. you have to equalize the pressure across the tympanic membrane by doing what? Maybe swallowing or chewing gum sometimes, right? Because this goes to your throat, or sometimes pinching your nose and pressurizing your face a little bit, and that forces some air up into this region right here, and now I can hear better again, okay? And also, if you're a little kid, little kids get infections of this area frequently. Anybody know what that's called when you get an infection of the middle ear? Otitis, right? Because oto is the ear, otitis, inflammation of the ear. But which part? Is it external, middle, or inner? Middle, so that's called otitis media. And when somebody has otitis media, this pharyngotympanic tube is plugged up. So it's really difficult for little kids to go flying on an airplane trip or go up in the mountains. They're going to misbehave when they're 1 or 2 years old. And when they're like a year old, you can't tell. Well, just clear your ears or pressurize it or chew gum, right? Because you can't give little kids gum. So they're just miserable when that happens. So don't smack them because they're misbehaving on a plane, because their ears are maybe killing them because they can't equalize, right? Talk to your physician about maybe getting some cold medication for them that will take the decongestion, will decongest this area right here. That could help them, all right? All right, so when we start, next time, we're going to go to the labyrinth right here. So that's what we're going to do next time. All right, sign-in sheet is going around someplace, too. Make sure you sign in. Talk to your instructors about the semester length. What would be better for you? Faster with more breaks, or longer so you don't have to work so hard when you're in school? And maybe it doesn't even make a difference. I don't know. Maybe in anatomy it's just painful no matter what. Yeah, Daniel. Otitis media.
Oh, that's
yeah, they get an inflammation. They get an inflammation. Now, here's something sort of interesting. People that surf a lot because they're in cold water, these bones develop calcifications in areas right here. Okay. Now, surfers here is a little bit different than swimmers here. So that can impair their hearing as these bones get bigger. It disrupts the auditory ossicles. So swimmers here, you have water coming in, and then the infection just kind of hops across the tympanic membrane right there. Yeah. So earplugs can help with swimmers here. You just can't hear very well. But if your head's underwater, you can't hear very well.